There's Mary, Joseph, John the Baptist, James the son of Zebedee, and Peter, Andrew, Matthew, Philip, Thomas, John, Bartholomew, and Simon, Zealot, Thaddeus, and James the son of Alphaeus, and Dismas, Paul, and Barnabas, and Stephen, Luke, Ignatius, Sylvester, Mary, Magdalene, and Martha, Mark, and Timothy, and Linus, Clement, Rufus, Tecla, Zosimus, Felicity, and Anacletus, Polycarp, Hippolytus, Perpetua, and Justin, Martyr, Christopher, Clement of Alexandria. There's Cecilia, Dennis, Ponchi, and Genesius, and Agatha, and John, and Paul, and Valentine, and Cyprian, and Barbara, and Gregory of Nyssa, Basil, Ambrose, Helen, Lazarus, Augustine, John, Chrysostom, Boniface, and Athanasius.
Darkness to Light, hosted by Alan and M. Middleton.
We aim to explore what takes place at the corner of theology and geekology.
Episode 48. Summer Pilgrimage, a.k.a. Popery, Popery.
Welcome to episode 48 of Dorkness to Light. This is our show where we take a look at pop culture in terms of where those stories intersect with concepts in religion, faith, theology, spirituality.
And this time, we're doing a road trip episode. We went to New England in August and had a few dorkness-appropriate happenings. So we're going to talk about that on this episode, and then that will probably spiral us off into a couple of different directions. There's just going to be sort of an assorted grab bag of topics here and there to sort of catch people up on what's been happening with us
true.
Recently, less recently.
The pop culture and comic book aspects of this family trip will eventually be chronicled over on Relatively Geeky, that podcast feed, in an episode of the brand new show, Alan's Eyes and Ears.
Heck yeah!
But before we get to the details of this trip and the subject matter of the episode, we should acknowledge that it's been a while since we got together to chat on this show. So, Em, what you been doing?
I was going to say, how long has it actually been?
13 months or so.
Oof.
The last episode was audio feed.
Oof.
Which occurred in July of 2022.
So. It's been a bit.
So you've been at your new job twice as long as
yep.
you were at last time we talked?
Yep. Job continues to be good, hectic, meaningful, fulfilling. We have acquired new noobs, which means that I am now officially a member of the senior staff, and that's terrifying.
Ooh.
Yeah. Now people are like, oh, don't worry. I know who can fix this. M. I'm like, oh, I don't care for that.
What do they call those things? Responsibilities?
Ugh.
Is that what you have?
Gross. Hate it. Disgusting.
My baby's growing up. New member of the family.
Because previous member of the family did pass away. Me and Kara's cat. Her cat that she had her entire adult life. Which is part of why it's been so long to record this. There have been a lot of happenings. Even the ones that are okay. Very busy and stressful
and
for the last 12 months. A couple months ago, acquired a new little baby kitten. And he's precious and adorable and the light of my life. So that's good. That's nice.
Right after we released that last episode, basically, late August of 2022, that my father passed away.
Yep.
And so we had, obviously, the stresses and traumas and strains of that.
Yep.
In addition to logistics and paperwork and lawyers and accountants and all of that and family and
that's just the thing, is grief is always terrible. Grief when you have to be responsible is worse. Grief when those responsibilities are three states away, absolutely. Yep. The rock bottom pits. That was a lot.
To say one Dorkness to Light themed comment, I thought the chaplain did a pretty nice job with the service.
I agree. It was nice. It was really, really nice. in the following of that, because of course it's all ups and downs. It's like finding all of the family genealogical stuff, which was super cool and interesting. And then going through stuff and like going through memories and all these things, which are good and bad and just in general a lot.
Still getting notes from my sister. Looking through some of Dad's old stuff. And look at this weird thing that I found that relates to me or you or something. Deal with that stuff for quite some time.
But we are getting back into the swing of things. School is starting back up for you. Again, there really is no downtime for me. Because we do have new noobs at work. They're starting to ask, so sort of like, okay, so like, where is the down season? It's like, oh.
That's funny.
Oh, that's hilarious. There's not. The slow season is a joke. The time when we get caught up on shelving is a joke. Like, it's a joke. Don't worry. After a while, it'll be safe for you to take vacation. Also a joke. No, those are just things that we tell the new people so that they feel better. And then eventually they realize we're lying to them. But, you know, it's for their own good, so it's fine.
Because in the book business, you've got, let's say, it's a little bit of back to school, end of summer stuff that is flowing into
Halloween.
You start thinking about Halloween. Christmas is not that far away from that time of year.
Black Friday is holding the line and just barely.
Your bookstore is a tourist destination. So
fall lots and of groups spring come breaks. Up
to get through the Christmas rush.
Then it's recovery from the Christmas rush.
I get summer break. You get summer reading season.
Yep.
So mid-February to mid to late March, maybe, is your 6 weeks of downtime?
Yeah, I think probably day after Valentine's Day to day before St. Patrick's Day. That's the slow season.
Because once you get into even the spring starts, Easter, Mother's Day, you said graduation. is a big time. And that is when you get to help. You've said so many of your favorite things is to help the grandfathers and the mothers figure out what would be good gifts for their graduating high school or college student who likes this sort of thing.
Can
you help me, Em?
Yes. Yes, I can. I am a professional. Yes, I can help.
Now, I did have a couple of Dorkness-themed books.
Ooh, yes.
That I wanted to talk about that I've read since our last episode. One that I finished up a while back is called A Man at Arms by Stephen Pressfield, a writer of historical fiction. I just took these blurbs from the back cover copy. In the turbulent aftermath of the crucifixion of Jesus, officers of the Roman Empire acquire intelligence of a pilgrim bearing an incendiary letter from a religious fanatic to insurrectionists in Corinth. The content of this letter could bring down the empire. The Romans hire a former legionary, a solitary man-at-arms, intercept the letter, and capture the courier. Let's say they've downplayed exactly what his mission is.
Prevent!
By any means necessary. But something happens that neither he nor the empire could have predicted. And the religious fanatic in question is St. Paul.
Nice.
And the incendiary letter would later be known as 1 Corinthians.
Very nice.
The dangerous content is preaching an ethic of love in the context of community dedicated to Jesus, which is not what the Roman Empire is actually about.
No. So,
I thought that was a great concept. And what I liked about this is that, I mean, this does not meet the criteria of being a Christian novel, not put out by a Christian publishing house, which is probably why it's such a great Christian novel.
Yeah, usually the best are.
It was a great, fun, adventurous read.
We recently got an advanced reader copy for a book about the white ex-evangelical, movement. And one of my coworkers was sort of reading along and was like, ooh, that sounds really interesting. I was like, yeah. And then all of them will go on to write the most banger chart-topping singles for the following 10 or 15 years. Mumford and Sons and Imagine Dragons and The Grey Havens and...
It's true.
The Oh Hellos, who got very popular on TikTok.
There's some, some potential art that gets unlocked, unleashed at times.
Wait a minute. I'm starting to unpack some of my deep-seated yearning and also my psychological trauma at the same time. You know what this is going to be? An absolute banger of a sad boy song. And I will listen to it 900 times on Spotify.
Yes. Yes, you will. Another book, actually with some similarities to that one, one I've just barely started, is called The Lyra and the Cross by Elizabeth L. Sammons. Three friends, two cultures, and one faith. Thus begins the life-changing journey to Jerusalem for Saul of Tarsus, his best friend Stephen, and Stephen's little sister, Irene. The rule of Rome and the rise of rabbis like John the Baptist have transformed Palestine into a cauldron boiling over with political and religious anger. The death of Jesus a few years later throws the Jewish world into discord. This novel looks deeply into two distinct worldviews, the Hellenic and the Jewish. Along the way, stories of slaves becoming freedmen, people seeking their roots, and souls questioning their beliefs intersect with the start of a new faith, later to be called Christianity.
That one sounds dope.
My understanding is that it's telling the story of Saul, and it leads up to his road to Damascus experience. It's right. Telling his life up until that point. His interactions with his Jewish culture and the new burgeoning sect of Christianity.
It sounds really, that really good. The first one sounded pretty good also. That blurb reminded me of one of our favorite recommendations. One of my favorite recommendations, definitely. The Inquisitor's Tale. Or Three Children and the Holy Dog by Adam Gidwitz. Like, it has that same sort of epistolary told from the perspective of a potential antagonist kind of vibe, which I'm very into. But that second one sounds amazing. So after you finish that, I might be interested in picking that up.
I will keep y'all posted.
Further notes to follow.
Two very quick mentions I wanted to make. I can't completely remember which series this was. I'm about 80% sure. It was from a two-novel duology by Brenda Cooper. And my favorite part of this novel, assuming it was one of those novels, was the AI system for the space station, which believed himself to be the actual St. John, as in the apostle.
The revelator, if you will.
The AI is unsure if he's a reincarnation of the apostle or somehow just contains his disembodied spirit. He hasn't worked out those details. All that matters is he knows that he is St. John.
That is wild.
It is. Let's just say it was an unexpected take on a character from a, you know, futuristic sci-fi novel.
That rules.
That was wild. And I will tease a short story that I recently read that I'm hoping perhaps my co-host will see their way to approving as a future episode of this fine show. Let's just say an angel, a golem, and the wandering Jew wander into a story. And
okay, see, I mean, come on.
That's all I can say at this point.
Again, what have I been doing while not recording this? Playing video games. But the current one is the video game Baldur's Gate 3. The final, long-awaited, never-expected-to-actually-happen third installment of the Baldur's Gate series from 2002!
Does this mean you've broken up with Dragon Age, or, I mean, does Dragon Age understand this, where they stand in your relationship?
They are literal cousins. It's the funniest thing in the world. BioWare made the first two Baldur's Gate games, and then they lost the license, so they made three Dragon Age games because they couldn't make Baldur's Gate 3.
That explains why you've been so fixated on Baldur's Gate, because it's pretty much more Dragon Age.
It is literally more Dragon Age content. Who knows when the fourth Dragon Age game is ever going to come out? Literally ever. Who knows? But the point is,
you're playing Baldur's Gate 6?
I am playing Baldur's Gate 6 at the moment. I'm having a wonderful time with it. And, of course, I'm playing a paladin. It's a Dungeons & Dragons game, and it gives me an option to be a paladin. Of course I'm going to be a paladin. So this, in combination with then rereading two of my favorite books, The Curse of Chalion, which we have definitely recommended on this show, and also the series NPCs, Spells, Swords, and Stealth by Drew Hayes, who we have also talked up quite a bit on this show and on the Relatively Geeky feed as well, has me just so deeply into my paladin feels. I am just so normal about the Oath of Devotion and about the manifestation of a tank type character whose whole purpose is to stand in the way of unassailable, like, onslaughts of evil and defend the innocent using their direct channel to the divine, functioning as both martyrs and saints, standing in as avatars of their god in order to be a service in the mortal world. I eat that up.
You are there to do the right thing because it's the right thing to do.
It's so incredibly tasty. And Baldur's Gate 3, no surprise, because it is working with the actual, like, Wizards of the Coast people who publish Dungeons & Dragons. It draws directly from the source material, from the lore for Dungeons & Dragons. Basically, if you've ever wanted to play single-player D&D because you just cannot get a group together, it's the same experience.
Okay. Okay.
So you all have all of your various different companions, which if you want a pre-made character, you can just pick one of them right out of the box and go. Or you can make your own. And if you make your own, there's a lot of really good stuff that's very responsive about, I am playing a cleric of this god particularly, and that means I'm going to have specific opinions about whatever thing we're interacting with, or certain people are going to be able to tell, well, since you're a paladin, or since you're a warlock, or since you're a tiefling, I'm going to have certain opinions about you. I'm having a blast, and one of my favorite things is that I broke my oath.
Ooh.
In previous Baldur's Gate games, I learned you got one, and it was like, you broke your oath, and you were just a fighter then. A very, very poorly built, very suddenly killable fighter for the rest of the game. Good job, you were not good enough to stay in the good graces of your god. In Baldur's Gate 3, you actually do get a couple of paths forward from that. That after you have given up on whatever your oath is, you either swear to vengeance, to protect nature, or devotion, your classic knight in shining armor.
Mm-hmm.
And if you break that dedication, there is a cutscene in which you feel the physical presence of your god abandon you.
Mm.
You are bereft. You lose your powers, but you also very specifically have an ongoing condition that just says oath broken. And you are not able to use any of the abilities that were given to you by your god until you get right. And you end up having a very, very cool and spooky interaction with a fellow fallen knight who sort of just tells you, you are at a crossroads, you have broken your oath, you have sullied the things that you pledged yourself to, you devoted yourself to be this manifestation, this like representation of your god in the world, and as a result, you have failed.
But
now, step two. The paths that you get forward are either do nothing, in which case you are just a bad fighter. You can do what you want, but nobody's going to take you seriously, and you do not have divine backing behind you. And you can make that work for a little while, but eventually you have to choose. You can either become an oathbreaker, full-blown, not try to get back with your god, lose all of your divine abilities, and instead gain necrotic abilities. Mm. You can no longer bless, only bane. You can no longer heal, you can only harm.
Oof.
Which is pretty freaking tasty, just in general, because it draws a lot of cool parallels between paladins and warlocks. That a warlock is someone who has made like a pact with some powerful undead or demonic thing, and as a result has gotten these magical powers, but they come under very strict requirements and always at a cost. Baldur's Gate 3 underlines that the same is true for paladins.
Nice.
You have entered a contract.
Right.
You are as bound as a warlock is by their pact, but by your oath. The difference being, you can get out of it. And the Oathbreaker sort of points out, and if you are no longer interested in doing the will of your god for a number of reasons, you don't have to. They will not seek you out, but you will also never be the same. There will be consequences.
I like the consequences.
The alternative option is to take a redemption path.
Nice.
And while it's pretty short in-game for mechanical reasons, it also hits really freaking good. Because you have to answer the reason that you broke your oath, and then re-swear your oaths. It comes with a cost, in this case, literally financial. And there's even a line that says, buying my way to redemption doesn't seem the right path. And the Oathbreaker will kind of slam dunk you about it because he's like, well, considering that's how much the price on my head was when I was alive and I was hunted like a dog, I don't think I appreciate being told that your redemption comes cheap. Fair point. But you get a moment where you have to explain why you broke your oath in the first place and then say why you want it back now. And you get that sort of moment to take a chance and reflect on, hang on, what does this mean? Because I just picked Paladin when I was making my character because, yeah, of course I want to play a martial class with really high AC who can talk their way out of anything and also smite things for triple damage. Why wouldn't I want that?
But did you really want that?
Did you really want that? Because now you have a chance to say, yeah, I definitely want that back. It's also funny because if you break your oath, there's an NPC in the game who will, like, resurrect you. He's a good guy lich. And he hates Oathbreakers. It's awesome. I have never been so thoroughly yelled at as when I went to him because I was like, hey, so I broke my oath. Can I, like, change class? Can I, like, respect just as a fighter? And he yelled at me. He told me that I needed to seek penance. Yes, sir, Mr. Undead, sir. I will rightly go get right with God. And you get a very cool spooky scene where that happens, where, again, divinity manifests in front of you. It travels into you. You get, like, these freaky glowing eyes because you have re-sworn your oaths. You are getting reconnected. There's, like, a direct divine channel that goes from your God into you. It is a tether. It Nice. Gives you abilities, but it ties you to them, too. And did you want it? Do you want it back? It's real freaking nice, good. And nice. Again, ties into Curse of Chalion, which was one of my favorite books ever for having the incredible line, a saint is not a virtuous soul, but an empty one. The gods can no more enter this world through a willing soul, as in like a soul with will, than I can pour wine into a cup through its bottom. And that is so good. That is so good for the concepts of dedication, devotion, meditation, service. That ties all of that so well together. And to tie into NPCs, a paladin is not a vessel of goodness, but a vessel of godness. Mm-hmm. And they are not always the same mm-hmm. thing.
Interesting.
Point is, I have been having a great time. I'm feeling energized and reinvigorated and having a pretty good one. So in between playing Baldur's Gate 3 and writing Dragon Age fan fiction, because who knows when I'll actually get another game, I want to be reading more, putting those thoughts together, making more episodes of this podcast.
There you go. So that is what we've been doing on our in the last year.
Yeah.
We've been doing in the last year. So now, that's not totally why we're here, though. We are here to talk specifically about the religious things we did on our summer vacation. And the logistics of that trip were, it started with me and your mom. The two of us drove to Rhode Island. His mom spent 6 years living there as a kid. We found the old house, the old church, the old school, the old library.
The fire tower.
She seemed to have an awesome time.
Which was, in and of itself, a sort of pre-pilgrimage.
Yes, yes. We headed up to Boston. I had an academic conference there. And towards the end of that stint, you flew up. And we had a blowout dinner with a couple of our internet buddies and their significant ladies. And that dinner included former Dorkness to Light guest, Chris Tyler, who was on the Babylon 5 discussion back in episode 34. And then the three of us, you, me, and Mom, took our time driving back to Ohio with stops for family and an actual, honest-to-God, pilgrimage. But first, a couple things in Boston I did want to mention. One thing I saw, which may have been the most Boston thing that ever Bostoned.
Yes.
because our hotel was attached to a mall. It's an upscale mall. Fortunately, Mom managed to not bankrupt us. I'm just saying.
I'm sure it was a struggle, and we commend her self-control.
But there, in an actual mall, was an operational Catholic chapel. St. Francis Chapel, staffed by the Oblates of the Virgin Mary. And when I say operational, I check the sign. Confessions available 6 days a week. Exposition of the Blessed Sacrament every day, and I counted 26 masses per week. Did I mention them? This was in an upscale mall in downtown Boston.
It was literally right next to the Sky Bridge.
What is happening here? And then to add a little bit of humor to that, directly across the aisleway in the mall from the chapel is, of course, a Dunkin' Donuts. So I managed to get a picture of the sign for the chapel and the sign for Dunkin'. It looks like they're, you know, commingling.
One sign.
It's like, you know, your two holiest places in Boston.
It's the combination Catholic chapel and Dunkin' Donuts.
That which would be so perfect. So I imagine that photo will be on the blog or used as the image on this podcast somewhere. So
it's going to be all over Twitter. Like,
check that out.
It's everywhere.
Did I mention this was in a mall? And this is one where we need Dave McElvaney. We need some of our other Catholic friends to tell me.
To weigh in.
Is this like an East Coast thing? is East Coast cities with big Catholic populations? Is Philadelphia, Baltimore?
It's a mall.
Are there malls there with operational Catholic chapels? And again, this was not just here's your little quiet space, your non-denominational prayer room at the airport. It was not that.
It was staffed by oblates.
26 masses in a week. Did I mention that part? It was.
And also next to the Dunkin' Donuts.
Next to the Dunkin'. Well, that just makes sense. It was crazy. It was wild. I did want to mention a couple things at my academic conference.
Yes.
One of the tracks that I was interested in was management, spirituality, and religion, of course. And a couple presentations I wanted to just mention quickly. One of the cool ones was from someone who took the very common, famous model of communications. If you've ever taken a comms 101 class, you've seen this model. But they mapped the book of Acts onto it, showing how the spread of the gospel in the days of the early church fits this communications model.
For expression of ideas and things like that. That's really cool.
Very interesting. There's also an interesting one by a Hindu presenter who talked about a specific type of architecture. As he said, it's not feng shui, but you can sort of think of it as feng shui. About architecture and then decor within a building in terms of, you know, your light and airflow, and he didn't say ley lines, but sort of, you know, getting your latitude and longitude and east, north, south, west in ways that could increase employee energy, peace, happiness at work. Well, that was kind of a cool presentation too. Just couple of ways that spirituality and its various manifestations interact with the workplace.
Very cool. Now, coming back from Boston, we did also specifically visit a real actual pilgrimage site for an actual Catholic saint. And so we're going to talk a little bit here about our feelings about Catholicism, which you can generally sum up as pretty warm. Mm-hmm. I mean, our whole family is moderately eclectic, let's say, and slightly non-normative in our religious beliefs and practices. Just basically, we don't really get into the whole Protestants versus Catholics thing, as an example. Because if everyone is listening, you do remember correctly, we took a family trip 6 years ago in order to celebrate the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation. So we are not Catholic. We would generally fall under the Protestant umbrella, although in my case, even that's a little bit fuzzy. We don't really draw those sort of strict intra-faith I'll just say it, fandomish lines between, you know, various sectarian divisions that a lot of other people tend to do. So even though we are generally speaking Protestant, generally evangelical-ish, we are not anti-Catholic, which is, again, kind of a little bit of an oddball now and then.
For me, the context in which I came to faith is important here. I was in college, and I fell in with the Inner Varsity Group, which is an eclectic ecumenical Christian group. So basically, I grew up in the faith in a context where we didn't agree on everything, but we could freely explore and express. So that group would have had Calvinists and Arminians, cessationists and charismatics, conservatives and progressives, feminists and traditionalists. And we all got along. So I learned how to get along Christianly in that context. There were denomination-specific groups on campus as well. So, folks who didn't want an eclectic experience could certainly go to their specific group. But I liked that experience. And I think that was formative in shaping who I became, and I think in the type of Christian that I became. But all that being said, that was still a Protestant group. But that changed. And I think I was in my junior year. A couple of freshmen found us. I say a couple because they were actually a couple. High school sweethearts.
Aw.
Came to college, and I have a very vague recollection. Your mom could not confirm this.
I was going to say, first question, did you check with her?
Their names, I thought, were some Brian and Missy, so I probably will call them that. The nice thing is that's probably not correct, which is probably the safest thing to do, seeing as I just called them out on a podcast.
Yes.
But in a positive way, as you'll find out. Because there was a Catholic group on campus, but these two both joined and participated fully in Inner Varsity. And so before I was exposed to very much in the way of negative anti-Catholic stereotyping, I had these great examples of kind, patient, generous, loving Catholic people. So when I did run across anti-Catholic bigotry, when I have a story, I was able to instantly dismiss it. Because the first church that your mom and I went to after we married was in the Christian and Missionary Alliance. That's where you were dedicated. And we left there when you were probably two or three. Joined up with the Vineyard Movement, where we've been ever since. But there, at the back of the sanctuary, when, you know, on your way out, they had a table, had information about church stuff and the Our Daily Bread, you know, booklet type of things, yeah, handouts, flyers.
With a little, like, you know, weekly devotion, follow-along things.
Yep, all that sort of stuff. And one Sunday, there was a stack of tracts. And I picked one up, and this, I would later learn, was one of the dreaded chick tracts. And look.
I can't believe on this, the day that I talk about Dungeons and Dragons,
chick tracts come up. Because you may think that Jack Chick hated rock music in D&D and the gays. But you know who he really hated? That was Catholics.
Yeah.
So I think people are familiar with the sort of the legend or the notion of the statues of the Blessed Mother that cry. And this tract was, Why is Mary Crying? And explain that Mary cried because so many people in the world had been deceived by the Pope. And they were worshiping Mary instead of worshiping God and all that stuff. And it was cranked up to 11. It was terrible. It was so harsh that I determined the next Sunday, when I went back, I was going to complain about it. Because I hadn't read it till we gotten home. But the next Sunday, those tracts were gone, never to reappear. So someone must have questioned it, or the pastor saw it and removed it. And that's always been my headcanon. My headcanon has always been that one of the older congregants, or maybe an elder, put those out. And the pastor, who is actually much younger, closer to our age, remove them. But however it happened, the right thing was done. That's why I mentioned them by name, the Christian Missionary Alliance, because quickly, the right thing was done.
Yeah, they saw that and said, oh, absolutely No. We will not be having that here, please and thank you.
So I was pleased by that. So I've always been predisposed to, I think, maybe appreciate, to like Catholics and Catholicism. For one thing, traditional Catholics and I have one significant thing in common. And that is that I love Mary. You can take your Paul and your Peter and your St. John or your Elijah, Noah, Moses, whatever. My favorite character in the Bible, not even close, is Mary. And there have been Bible studies where I've mentioned that. It's like okay, who's your favorite person in the Bible?
Who do you look up to most in the Bible? And your hand shoots up immediately. Mary!
I'll mention that. You get a few odd looks, then usually someone will come over at, you know, snack time afterward and say, oh, I didn't know you were raised Catholic. Nope. Not the case. I just read the Bible and she's awesome.
I just think she's neat.
There's nothing wrong with that. So that's sort of been, so it's been my experience with Catholicism and Catholics.
My experience is then growing up in that type of household where, again, not raised Catholic, but raised by a non-Catholic who really likes Mary. That kind of thing, like, trickles
off
through
a little bit.
Just a bit. So, like, I've always been aware of the Catholic traditions and have been moderately positive towards them. I will say, similarly, it was quite a shock going into my middle school and high school years at my Christian, in this case, read Protestant, very, very, very notably Calvinist Protestant high school.
That's a double whammy.
Yeah, when all of a sudden we'd be talking in our religion class and I'd be like, no, hang on a second. You just said that Catholics aren't Christian. And I think that if you actually look at a timetable of the history of Christianity, they have actually been Christian longer than anybody else. Just FYI. Oh, see, also the one time that I literally raised my hand in the middle of class and, like, talked to a dude and was like, so are you saying that you don't actually follow the Nicene Creed? Also a pretty proud moment for me personally.
Well, that is actually one of my go-to arguments, is that the Nicene Creed, the Apostles' Creed, very basic, straightforward version of Christian doctrine. I'd like to say, now, that was adopted in the 350s or so AD. People who came up with that, you know they were Catholic, right? And I'm saying, not just Catholic in the way, well, everyone was Catholic.
Or everyone in Boston is Catholic.
Exactly.
Not that kind of Catholic, like the OG Catholic.
But the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, the canon of Scripture, these were all developed by people who believed in the bodily presence in the Eucharist, prayed for Mary's intercession during the councils that ended up with these things that you treasure and believe wholeheartedly in. If you love the Bible, where did we get that from? We get that from Catholics, like real, actual, super see Catholic people, and you have to reconcile that somehow in your head. And I never had a problem with that, as you said.
Some people do.
Protestants and evangelicals do have
problems
connecting those particular dots.
But you, I will always say, did give me a good baseline for that, so that I did not fall into any of that, and I felt confident in and willing to call it out when it did pop up, because I was like, no, that does sound like some hot garbage. I will say also the funniest thing is that in my own sort of like wanderings around of like where I have sort of ended up.
Post-evangelical wilderness.
Yes, exactly. That I definitely like mostly live in a tent in the post-evangelical wilderness. But occasionally when I want to come into civilization for some supplies, I do occasionally, you know, come in from the storms every now and then to St. Matt's, which is an Episcopalian you know, American no. Anglican church.
Catholicism light.
Which Kara absolutely dragged me for constantly for being a Catholic light. Which is, again, funny, because with her being a pagan, we will also go to the mm-hmm. pagan store, which is always, like, fun and neat, and I don't mind wandering around there with her. It's always a fun time. But then she loves to drag me and say, oh, yeah, stuff and things, and, you know, but they don't actually, like, practice anything. You know, they are a Catholic light. They're not even a cool enough Catholic to need any sorts of charms or, you know, saint imagery or whatever. Like, they're not even that cool of a person that they could just go be full Catholic. And I was like, I love that in your mind, going full Catholic is like the peak.
That's the extreme of and something. And I'm like,
I so thoroughly approve of that.
So all of this brings us to about 2008 or 2009 or so. In our early days as podcast listeners.
Yes.
And this is when Kateri Tekakwitha crossed our path. Or at that point, blessed
Kateri. We're just going to take a brief little digression here and talk about the rankings of the honored dead within Catholicism. Because the great cloud of witnesses, the perseverance of the saints. This is all a very central Catholic idea that the dead saints and martyrs are all still watching over and interceding for the living.
Saint Dave of McIlvany, have mercy on us.
Yes.
We're
doing our best.
Wander through this.
But the first level of that, in the process of canonization or of becoming a saint, is to be declared venerable, a ranking that famously includes the great church historian.
The Venerable Bede.
And then the process of evaluating beyond that, if you're getting sanctified, would be moving on into blessed, where there is some indications of this person's life is in some way inspirational and not just important practically, where they were a great mm-hmm. historian or a writer, people who were involved in it sort of like a theological mm-hmm. sort of scholarly context, to then going beyond that to this person in some way typifies the ideals and values that people should respect and emulate, admire, and be inspired by.
I like
something
the phrase,
their life.
A life of heroic virtue.
Yes.
That's the phrase that I've often heard in this context. A venerable does not always get promoted to blessed, and blesseds do not always get promoted to sainthood, but those are the steps in that process. And did you know that the phrase, the devil's advocate, comes from this process? So when you're getting to that sainthood stage, and it's looking, you know, strong or possible for the candidate, a separate investigation is undertaken to look for, you know, the dark stuff, to look for reasons against the case for sainthood. Reasons the person should not be declared as such. It's kind of like in a political campaign, you look for opposition research.
Oh.
You look for, like, what are the worst things? What's the worst case scenario that we could argue about this person? And that is taken into consideration as well. And that person is called the devil's advocate.
Which makes a lot of sense, considering, again, this is a very important thing. You do not want to sanctify someone who it then turns out was a horrible screaming monster.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the late 1900s, 1950 to 2000, I don't know if it was related to Vatican II, but in that same general area, the Catholic Church did a sort of
like an audit?
Top to bottom review of the saint calendar and removed the ones that at least were purely legendary. That's why February 14th is technically just Valentine's Day now.
Yeah.
Because he ain't a saint no more. Not because they found anything terrible about him, except that we don't think he existed.
He may not have been an actual person. This might not be an actual sainted dead that we are praying to.
You know,
so
you appreciate
the
seriousness with which they took that that investigation. Now, in the early days of podcasting, going back to that, one of the pioneers in religious podcasting was a young Dutch Catholic priest, Father Roderick. If you are online and you are familiar with that priest guy who loves Star Wars?
Yeah, the geek priest.
The geek priest that loves Lord of the Rings. The guy that makes Legos of famous church events. And that's Father Roderick.
Yeah, that's him. That's the guy.
There's a good chance you have run across him. But he organized a good-sized network of podcasts, one of which was The Saint Cast.
I loved The Saint Cast.
Excellent show. The problem was too well produced and too researched for the host to keep up with it, who had a side gig literally as a neurosurgeon.
Yeah.
And I remember him announcing in what would be, you know, the penultimate episode, basically, or you know, something to that effect, that he'd been promoted to department chair. I can't remember if it was like in a university hospital or if he was. So it's like, okay, he's not going to be able to do many podcasts anymore. Well over like 140 some episodes. It's still out there, by the way. It wrapped up around 2014, but those last 4 or 5 years, he was putting out 1 or 2 episodes a year. Do you know what that's like, Anne?
Yeah.
Can you believe someone would take that long
you
off?
And him.
Okay, I mean, we say that.
This is a joke.
In love, Dr. Paul. We say that in love. Okay. And it was on that show he did a Blessed Kateri episode and told her story. And all of us were transfixed.
Yeah.
By the story. Followed her canonization process, and she was declared a saint in 2012. And both the Kateri Shrine, that's where we went, and the Kateri Conservation Center are both great follows on Twitter. And somewhere through that, I saw that there was a physical location, a shrine and historic site located in upstate New York. If you're a baseball fan, not that far from the Baseball Hall of Fame, maybe an hour from Albany, up in the mountainous, very pretty regions of upstate New York. And you know, we sort of always had that on our wish list for when we went to the Northeast. We were scheduled for a trip in July 2020. COVID got that one, of course. But last month, August 2023, we made it all work.
And finally.
We spent a couple of very nice hours at the St. Kateri Tekakwitha National Shrine and Historic Site.
So we'll run through the basics of her biography here. Born in 1656 to a Mohawk chief and a Christian Algonquin woman who was captured in a raid and then assimilated into the Mohawk tribe there, where she lived near the location of the current shrine. At the age of 4, smallpox broke out in the village, her parents and her brother died, and then Kateri herself was left with a scarred face and permanently damaged vision. The bright sun blinded her, and so her Mohawk given name, Tekakwitha, means she who bumps into things or who walks by groping in the way.
I give him credit for literalist.
Yes.
Okay.
And I will say that this was the first point where I went, oh me, considering that I have the worst eyesight of anyone that I have ever met.
those are pretty thick glasses.
Pretty
there,
thick
huh?
glasses. So, she became skilled at arts such as beadwork and basket weaving and mostly undertook small handiwork in the community due to her physical disability and lived with her aunts in a traditional log house. As the result of a peace treaty with the French, the Mohawk allowed Jesuit missionaries into their settlements. When Tekakwitha was about 18, she began instructions in the Catholic faith. She had had warm memories of the stories her prayerful Catholic mother told her before her death. Then, in 1676, at the age of 20, she was baptized on Easter Sunday on the property that the shrine currently stands on. Kateri is the Mohawk form of the baptismal name, Catherine. Initially, she became an outcast among her family and her community. Because of this hostility and her desire to live her life working for God, she fled to the St. Francis Xavier Mission near current Montreal, a journey which took almost 2 months on foot. There, she received her first communion.
Remember, this is in the 1600s, So there's no national borders. So she's in upstate New York, into Canada. And so both Canada and the U.S. sort of have a claim to St. Kateri. And so the language you'll hear, she'll either be referred to as the first Native American saint or the first First Nations saint. You know, that language, it's a Canadian and American language.
At the time, there
was no Canada. There was no USA.
At the time, it was all just First Nations.
It was all
territory.
It was all the land.
So
yes.
it was all one space. One of her practices was to fashion crosses out of sticks and twine, an image which is usually included in her iconography. In 1679, at age 23, she took a vow of virginity, the first Native or First Nation person ever recorded to do so. Her health had never been strong, and in April of 1680, at the age of 24, she passed away. Within 4 years, pilgrimages to the site of her tomb had begun. And this is also speaking to the process of canonization, is one of the sort of signs of that, is the earlier a place becomes a site of pilgrimage, a site that's recognized as being important within the memory of that person, that is a very big indicator of how strong their case is going to be down the line. Because canonization is mostly intended to be a recognition of, if this person within their memory was considered to be important by the people around them, then that is
that's strong evidence.
Yeah. Like, have sort of a responsibility to continue remembering down the line. So, speaking of that process of canonization, she was declared venerable in 1943, blessed in 1980, and then canonized in 2012, a thing that we definitely celebrated.
Yes.
And along the line, earned the sort of secondary nickname title, the Lily of the Mohawks.
The national shrine that we visited was established to honor St. Kateri and to continue her legacy of devotion, healing, and intercultural encounter between natives and Europeans. And the site itself focuses on three elements. There's a lot of specific Catholic elements, of course, including an outdoor Stations of the Cross. You noticed that.
On the hills.
On the hills, yes. A lot of Native history, a Native museum that we went through. And then third, a lot of ecological information. She is the patron saint of ecology and the environment, in addition to people living in exile and Native Americans. Mention the St. Kateri Conservation Center, an organization that promotes faith, ecology, and the diversity of life. I'll put links to both of these. Conservation Center, that organization, and the shrine itself. Like I said, the Conservation Center does some fantastic work, and I love their, like I said, their Twitter presence. A little bit from their website, they say that with a focus on God and faith, St. Kateri habitats offer living sacred spaces for people to engage directly in the care of God's creation at home and in our local communities. By restoring habitats with reverence and gratitude for our Creator, the program draws people closer to God and His church while protecting the integrity of creation. And they promote, again, on the Twitter and on their website, these Kateri habitats that are around the country, I guess around the world as well. They're at your parish church or your Catholic school or just any neighborhood can petition to establish a Kateri habitat. And the idea of the habitat is to maintain a religious expression on the land to serve as a gentle reminder of God. I love that expression too. That His presence is everywhere and in everything, and of His transcendence. There will be a religious element in there as well, a cross or a shrine or a statue of Mary or a saint. All the other faith groups are invited to participate as well. St. Kateri habitats encourage individuals, families, parishes, schools, orders, and working landowners to restore and manage their land in ways that praise God, and foster a greater connection between God, people, and nature.
So we're going to talk a little bit here about how much we love the Sanctuary Conservation Centers just in general before we kind of get back to the history and cultural stuff, because literally the good works that the Sanctuary Group is doing are insane. They sponsor these sorts of habitats. Specifically, they work with creating community gardens, which are centered around parishes and Catholic schools, in order to talk about food security. They also, the thing that I'm most excited about when it comes to the habitats, and they also had this at the shrine, is specific native grass rewilding efforts. That is like their primary thing. Is it's gardens, but that's a thing that lots of people do. They specifically focus on prairies and on bringing back specifically wildflowers and unmown native diverse grasslands. And it is such an important thing and has been largely overlooked for so long. I'm always very excited whenever I see stuff about that, like in the news, about people working on rewilding spaces. And I always have a little like pat on the back to say that the Sanctuary Group has been ahead of that curve as far as public awareness for like a solid 10 years.
Because they're at the site. You have the mown areas and the path that you can walk to get to the stations and between the buildings.
It's very much a nature walk. And it's well maintained and the grass is all mown and all of these
things. And then there's another path off in one direction, and
there's a big giant sign that says ticks, and then right underneath it, a giant sign that says creating ecological diversity and providing habitats for native grasses and species are a vital point of Sanctuary's mission here. And I'm so we've got like half of the space, which is grass and trees and gardens and flowers, and still very maintained and pretty, tended. And then separately, the untended.
Yes.
And I'm like, good, both and.
Both and, yes. I saw that on site, they had done some excavation in the last 50, 60, 70 years in the village of
Kanagawa,
which was where, which was Kateri's home, was actually rediscovered in 1950 and is now the only fully excavated Iroquois
Haudenosaunee
village in the world. Thank you, M. You are young enough to say these words with boldness and confidence while I am terrified. So thank you.
I am trawling back to my one Indigenous history class like 18 years ago.
So I just love the way, like you said, that the site balances these things. It balances the history and the respect for the native heritage, the obviously religious elements, but also this ecological and environmental aspect, and really holding all of those things in balance or even in tension in some cases.
I think that's a very good thing to bring up because there was a historical center there. And I thought it did a pretty good job. This is always my test whenever I go into anything where there is going to be some sort of historical discussion about Native Americans, is to always go in and sort of look around at the artifacts that are on display. I was very happy to walk by a case that had a description of ceremonial objects and then a sign in it that said, "These artifacts have been repatriated out of consideration for the cultural practices." And I was like, that is how you know that people are doing at least adequately, like, responsible job engaging with trying to genuinely be respectful of those practices and of recognizing these people are still here. And there are things that should not be put up on display because it is disrespectful to people who are still living. There are still living communities, that this is not a thing to be like, well, you know, we'll put this away in a dusty museum. This is part of still a living practice and should be treated with respect. I was very pleased to see that. But it also didn't just remove things whole cloth. No. There were lots of things that were, the center was established in like the 1950s. And quite frequently there would be plaques and displays and art and things. And then there would be a little disclaimer underneath it that says, though this is an important work and it's a part of the history of Kateri, it is worth noting that this representation was made by a white person, mm-hmm. or this historical artifact has been brought into question. Mm. We cannot establish the provenance of this particular artifact. And I was like, that shows a good degree of honesty for mm-hmm. being like, we are a religious center, but we're not going to just let legend and story take over. We are going to try and genuinely be respectful to this person's native heritage, to a thing that was actually very important to her, being Algonquin and Mohawk, and then separately from being those two things,
also
which were
being
already
Catholic.
That is already in conflict there, in tension, to then additionally be a Catholic on top of that. All three of those things pulled her in different directions, and she lived that experience, mm-hmm. trying to keep that in the history instead of just saying, and then she was cast out by her people, and then she didn't value this, and she turned away from that. There were a lot of things where they were talking about various legends and stories that were passed down about Kateri. And then underneath that, again, a little plaque that says, it's worth noting that in Saint stories of this time, mm-hmm. certain things would be skimmed over. It's worth putting this in context with very next piece of documentation, which was from a native source. Mm. I think that they did a really responsible job of being accurate to their mm-hmm. own history of, we made this museum in the 1950s and here's what we said. We're not going to pretend we didn't, but we're going to also give more context further down the line.
And let me just say, just in putting this episode together, putting that little biography together, there is some question just how maltreated she was among her people that may have been exaggerated in some case. We do know that she left. I mean, we know that she fled to go to Montreal. Some view that may have just been more of her calling than being driven out by the tribe. And it's interesting that some of the stories focused more on, I mean, used words like persecution and driven out. And some said, maybe it wasn't that bad. I remember 5 episodes ago, whenever it was, when we were covering the Big Book of Martyrs, that, oh, this could be my chance to talk about Kateri. I know she died young, and there were these... No, that's right. She was not a martyr. She was not a martyr. I mean, she did not have an easy life.
No.
Let's say, but it was health-related more than the effects of this conflict of cultures. That must not have been easy. And the Kateri Shrine has recognized the fact that over the centuries, occasionally there have been conflicts between the Catholic Church and the natives in terms of the emphasis of Saint Kateri and making sure that her story is told in an honoring way of her heritage, where at various times over the last nearly 400 years, maybe the native elements were not just downplayed, but the negatives were...
Yeah.
Were exaggerated and in some cases made up out of whole cloth.
Yeah.
So that's genuine cases of
just straight up demonizing.
Yeah. The temptation in telling the same story is hagiography.
Yes.
And if you're going to do that and there are negative elements or elements of tension, what are you going to do with those? Demonization.
Yep.
And what I liked about the shrine in this modern day, the Kateri related sites understand that fully and are doing their best to deal with that tension.
Yeah. It continues to be an ongoing source of conversation and at times cultural conflict.
Friction, yeah.
Which is completely understandable and is honestly kind of as it should be if the Catholic Church got too comfortable mm-hmm. with the story of Kateri as this young Mohawk, Algonquin, Catholic, North American, Canadian, New York, if all of that stuff got completely sanitized and stripped away of its cultural context or mm-hmm. of her own experience of those things, it wouldn't mean anything anymore. It would just be a story made up out of whole cloth to make people mm-hmm. feel good about colonialism.
Yeah.
Some of the stories that were coming into that were really interesting because there was stuff about the works that she did. Like we talked about, it sort of very briefly in passing, but things like beadwork and basket making are like, those were key social activities. That right. is how you showed yourself as a member of this people, of having community, that these were her people. She did not have that kind of direct conflict of, I am not like you. Like, she didn't right. reject that. she was a part of it, and that the things that she did were then valued parts of her community, right. Which then intersects with disability and religion, mm-hmm. and honestly, a lot gender.
Right.
Because the idea of her leaving to go to Montreal in order to take a vow of,
right.
of I mean, virginity, of chastity, part of that, I mean, brings in that sort of element that it may have been less a, I want to leave my people and I want to abandon their 18,000 air quotes, horrible heathen ways. It may have been more a question of politics, mm-hmm. more a, I do not want to leave my family and my society in order to be married off to some other tribe where my religion will not be respected, right, right. actually.
It may have been a preventative elements as well, because, you know, the notion was, I mean, she'd gotten into her 20s unmarried, which is very unusual. And so certainly argue that the community, her tribe,
could have had pressures.
They were being very merciful and generous to her as well. Also, yeah. finding room for someone with extreme visual impairments as well. And so you can certainly tell the positive story of that, which is where this notion of her fleeing is really interesting. Fleeing exactly what? And it may be, like you said, it may have been just something beyond what we can think of. There may have been a, you know, potential tribe merger, royal houses, and at some point she was going to have to marry at some point, or whatever it would be, you know, because at some point you really are a burden to the community. And that's, adult and unmarried is very unusual in this community, in this time, for anyone. Of course, 20 is old maid.
Yeah, I know, absolutely. Ancient
territory at this point. So sort of
where especially if you are going to be a dependent, if you are not able to go out and necessarily do as much physical supporting of the community, it's like, well, then
there are some unanswered questions.
There are
really
a lot of
interesting
questions.
Elements here.
And again, it all comes back to what makes Kateri so engaging, mm-hmm. which is all of these intercultural external pressures that mm-hmm. just made her a person. Mm-hmm. Like, that's really what it sort of comes down to, is that she was just a very singular person who lived at a singular time. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we are able to honor her memory now, especially through things like ecological mm-hmm. well-being and through intercommunity discussion and working towards genuine listening and healing and cooperation. That's the kind of stuff that you can really take away from it, and to just know she was just some kid.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I asked you just basically as soon as we got there to the site was to help me not embarrass myself by doing anything too overtly Protestant or or offensively to our Catholic brothers and sisters. I did not go into the little candle shrine.
Into the actual shrine.
You went into the shrine. What were your experiences there?
It was very, very nice. Again, I am not Catholic, mm-hmm. but I had done this before when I went to Europe for the castles and cathedrals class.
That's right.
I visited several other Catholic shrines at various
times. I was just afraid I was going to knock down some candles. This could be bad.
And you know,
CNN is going to know about this if I go in. That's my only concern.
And you just sort of like walked and went, I am going to walk with such care on this land. There are so many potential pitfalls, which I am going to avoid all of.
I will read the signs outside this small building,
and I will
take a few steps back.
And I will walk around, and I will look at the Stations of the Cross up on the mountain. I have a nice contemplative moment in nature.
Yes.
Big thumbs up. I did go inside. It was very nice. It was a small, mm-hmm. well-maintained mm-hmm. little shrine. Had a carved icon, mm-hmm. which was very nice. It looked similar to like sort of the famous painting of Kateri Lily of the Mohawks. Based off of like that one specific painting.
There is one image that was created by an artist who didn't know her in real life. So they're a little more comfortable using that as
the
official portrait.
And that's
the
one that they
portrait.
Sort of yes. put up everywhere. There's a big sign of that particular painting right in front next mm-hmm. to the shrine itself. The shrine also had a little making of little reliquary we mentioned before about like where a place where you could make your own little crosses. I did not do that one. I was like, that's more of a directly contemplative religious practice. I will leave that one be. Mm-hmm. But I did go into the shrine and I did walk around it a little bit. Again, very small, but tiny, tiny little like walled in cupola with a statue and a kneeling bench. But I walked around and sort of read some of the signs. It was mostly, you know, like little things that were, you know, dedicated to so-and-so who has like upkept this shrine, which was nice. And a suggested prayer for if you were taking your communion at the shrine, which was also nice. Lit a candle. That was.
And you did not burn the shrine down.
I did not burn down the shrine. I did not. All that matters. At the end of the day, I did not burn down the shrine. We did not damage any of the religious or historical.
I was just not sure I could make that promise.
It was very small. There would not have been room for two people at a time, which also kind of feels kind of right.
Yeah. Now, following the shrine on their Twitter feed, I knew that they were looking for employees.
Yes.
And so because of that, there was not a docent there or a guide. And unfortunately, the gift shop was closed. Although I may have to PayPal myself a few.
From their online store. Because we did probably save a good chunk of money. We would have dropped a good amount.
There was a suggested donation for the museum tour, and I overindulged a little bit there, but I think I left some money in my wallet by not having the gift shop open. I feel kind of bad about that.
It was a really good time. I did, for all of our like slightly tongue-in-cheek discussions of pilgrimage, I really did feel centered. I felt like we'd accomplished something of sort of the long process of following Kateri's canonization for like literally over a decade.
For us, it had been 15 years since we'd heard of her and heard of her case and all of that. So it really was a culmination of those events.
You still
for us.
Send me texts about Kateri, and you forward me the Twitters, the really good Twitters.
Things from the Twitters, yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. So
I would say really good experience overall, mentally stimulating, spiritually meaningful. Also, just in general, because we were in the middle of a separate pilgrimage at the time that we took this sub-pilgrimage, really great to get out of the car for 2 hours.
That's true. And very true.
Breathe
very
air true. And walk around, have a quiet contemplative moment after a really, you know, pretty emotionally taxing and physically taxing week and a half.
There are a lot of things I like about living here in the Midwest. One thing I miss about living more on the East Coast is what do they call those big things that go up and down out of the ground?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, mountains and hills and things.
Yeah.
Gorgeous there, of course, because you have literal rolling hills. And we were there in August. I mean, everything was green. And obviously, it's well-maintained because of their commitment, but beautiful. Very glad that we did that.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's to rest on Bosco Maria Goretti, Elizabeth and C. Tonin, Martin, Vincent, Bernadette, Antonio, Andrew, Kim, Degon, John Michael, Gani, John Vianney, Teresa, Benedicta, Maximilian, Catherine, Drexel, Padre Pio, Johanna, Mola. These are the only saints for lack of breath that I could mention, but there's many thousands more that are deserving your attention.
And we're back, because we have awesome listeners who send us awesome feedback on the regular. It means it's time to go through our bag of emails, faxes, and notes. And our old good friend Neil Stanifer reached out recently. Hello, Professor Allen. It's been a while since I wrote to UNM, and I wanted to check in and see how you've been. I'll be honest, my podcast listening has filled up with politics recently for reasons I trust you understand given what's going on in America today. But I've recently picked up Dorkness Delight again. And at almost the same time, I've heard an episode of the Bulwark podcast that reminded me of UNM. On a recent episode, host Charlie Sykes, a lifelong conservative Catholic, interviews Russell Moore, the editor of Christianity Today and a lifelong evangelical. The episode delves into the modern evangelical movement and its discontents, from the gaslighting over sexual assault to the steady bleed of congregants from the flocks, It's a fascinating episode and interview, and I strongly recommend it. It put me in mind of our back and forth about the difficulty and inconvenience of truly practicing Christianity, as distinct from merely saying one is Christian. Give my best to your family. Cheers, Neil.
Thanks, Neil. Our dear friend Stella said also that she enjoyed our Book of Martyrs coverage, a thing she realized she forgot to tell us at the time.
Oh, thanks, Stells.
On our previous episode about Audio Feed 2022, both Prop and Ravener thanked us for covering their shows and giving them shoutouts. And then you also went back and forth a bit with Rusty Ship, one of our faves, just purely based on the name. Also, his music is very good. Who said lots of nice things about the episode.
Yeah.
And, of course, our good friend Dave McElvaney also wrote in on that episode. I always enjoy hearing your talk about Audio Feed, not because I share very much of your musical tastes, but because it's clear how very much you all enjoy it. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that Kara got to experience it and have a good time. It's always a bit worrisome, I guess, when you share something that you love with someone who hasn't experienced it before. Will they hate it? Will they like it? Will they like it as much as I do? That's the big one.
I think that's a great point. Was that like the way Dave phrased this? I'm glad that Kara got to experience it, comma, dash, and had a good time.
Yes.
Those two things
are two things.
Always very separate potential things.
Dave says, I was happy to hear about the hotel waffles. My wife and I generally choose free breakfast hotels whenever possible and always enjoy those.
Now, one of the things we did not mention about our vacation time was that the hotel nearest the Kateri Shrine, what, 15 minutes away, did not sadly have a waffle maker for breakfast. But Em, what did they have?
They had something better. A pancake printer.
What was in essence a 3D pancake printer. You hit one button.
You swipe. It was non-touch. Right. You swipe your hand. And it had just a little nozzle that would drop silver dollar pancakes. It would make two pancakes and then put it on a little conveyor belt. Right under the heat press so that it would get nice and crispy right on the top and baked from the bottom. And it would just pop right out and it would just fall over. And it was two perfectly made pancakes.
Non-touch.
Non-touch, no pancake. Contact, automatic pancake maker.
Dave, put that on your list.
I don't know
you
how much they go for, but
that.
Like, I need one. I need one of those desperately.
But back to Dave's email.
Yes. Dave mentioned that since I said I was putting Propaganda's book on their staff pick slot, I ordered a copy this morning. My only regret is I couldn't stop into the book loft and pick it up in person. I love that place. The one and only time I've been to Columbus.
If you're coming into Columbus for only one thing, there are two possible things that one thing could be.
Yes. OSU football.
OSU football in the book loft.
That's it.
Those are really
it's
the two.
One or the other. If you are pilgrimaging to Columbus, Ohio, it's for one of those things. Dave wraps up. By the way, Alan's comment about the game of Buck Buck brought a flood of childhood memories. When I was a lad and dinosaurs roamed the earth, this was quite a popular game in my Philadelphia neighborhood. Often in summer, we'd play until the streetlights came on and we had to go home. Sadly, when I recently asked my youngest sister if she and her friends had played that game when she was a kid, she'd never even heard of it. I think I should just go and yell at some kids to get off my lawn.
Shout out to Ben Avery at the Christian Sci-Fi podcast, Strangers and Aliens. Earlier in the year, he did a video in which he recommended four other podcasts that were operating in similar spaces. And for each one, he gave a two-word description. We were on his list, thank you. And we were described as thoughtful conversation.
Dig that.
Mission accomplished. And shout out to our buddy and former guest, Garrett Godfrey of the Good Patron podcast, who came to Central Ohio for work. And he came down to Columbus on a Sunday, went to church with me and your mom, and then we took him down to your store to experience the glory that Dave McElvaney spoke of, the glory that is the book loft. The
pilgrimage.
Man made his pilgrimage.
And you guys went to Stoff's, which is the only other thing that matters.
That's right. And a shout out goes to my co-host, M.
What, me?
Who in our recent 10-year celebration episode, over on our mainstream podcast feed, Relatively Geeky, we talked about bringing some of our podcasts over there to an end. Talked about what we were going to do in the future from this point forward. And you said, it's been recorded. You actually said it about 45 minutes ago also, so no getting around this.
No, it's official.
You said that one of the areas you wanted to focus on, put your creative energies toward, was the Darkness to Light podcast. Aww,
you're welcome.
Me too. Me too. So, thank you, everybody. We love you all for listening. We know that this show occupies a small niche within a small niche and value each and every one of you.
And wherever you come from, within the wide Christian world, or if you consider yourself outside that entirely, you can come here. All are welcome. And until next time, may the Force be with you.
And also with you.
While you're waiting for the next podcast episode, check out our websites. DarknessToLight.blogspot.com contains reviews, essays, and other similar ramblings.
And DarknessToLight.tumblr.com, which contains some of that material, as well as top tens, cool photographs, memes, and religious puns. We also run a general interest comic book podcast network, Relatively Geeky. That content can be found at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com or by searching iTunes for Relatively Geeky.
Let us know what you think of this topic, this episode, or this podcast in general. Feel free to send your thoughts to us at darknesstolight@gmail.com. We would also appreciate any ratings or reviews left for the podcast in the iTunes store to help like-minded people find us.
Our intro, outro, and promo music is all provided by Anderson Kale. Search for them online to listen to or purchase their music.
Thanks for listening.
Episode 48. Summer Pilbert.
It's been a while.
It's been a bit. The rain in Spain. The first one definitely also reminded me of one of our favorite recommendations. Oh my God, what is it?
It's the three kids.
Three kids and the holy dog. What is it?
Saint. Is it? It's got a saint in it. I'm pausing. Nope. Leave it in. End of show content.
Yeah, leave it in, because I am just going to Google real quick. Three
the holy dog
children
of...
Holy dog. Gwenford. Okay, cool. The Inquisitor's Tale or Three Magical Children. Okay, I wanted to hold on to that because the spoiler at the end of that book is that the person who's reading all of them is an Inquisitor. But the movie was called The Inquisitor's Tale.
So, Kateri?
I'll actually...
You want to do it all?
I'm just going to do it all. Rolling. Thanks. It also involves a lot of indigenous words, which I can give a good stab at, and people will probably be forgiving if I heck it up.
Not conversation center.
Conservation.
Not conservatism. No, wait.
Conservation.
It's the other one. In the museum, there were like the portrait area.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a note on that as well. Was that they were only native?
That was the one about that they were famous portraits and they were important portraits, but that we don't stand by the depiction.
Yes.
Because it was definitely a white fantasy view of Native Americans. It was not heavily researched, did not have Native American input.
Something there.
Yeah, that was the one, was the portraits that they were like, we are keeping them up because they were donated to the museum, but we're also going to put context on those of we don't really necessarily stand by the depiction of those anymore.